So welcome everyone to our JCC Coffee Cake and Learning, So Let It Be Written, So Let It Be Done, our pre-Passover class, 2024-5784. So let us begin with something that we touched on at the previous Passover class. This is source number one. And by the way, I have official permission license from Cecil B. DeMille and Yul Brenner to say, so let it be written, so let it be done. So don't worry, it's not copyright infringement. So we begin our story, our Haggadah night. So this Monday night, he begins, it says, the story of the Exodus with Israel's disgrace. And he concludes, meaning the one at the Seder, at your Passover Seder, with Israel's praise. Well, what is meant by Israel's disgrace? Rav, this great rabbi of the Talmud in Babylonia, said, the point that we begin with the disgrace is with the words mitchila. Originally, our ancestors were idol worshippers. And Shmuel, Samuel, who was a contemporary of the great Rav in Babylonia, he said, no, avarim ayinu. No, the part where we talk about the disgrace, the disparagement of the ignoble beginnings of the Jewish people with the words, we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. And it's, of course, a famous moment because it's a song that has like six words and then we repeat it ad nauseum, right? Avarim ayinu, hayinu. It's a famous song. So nowadays, according to this source, meaning 2024, but also hundreds of years ago in the time of Rabbi Alfasi, we act according to both of their opinions. So in other words, and we discussed this. So if you're at my last class, I'm sure this is just a refreshment for you. Rav and Shmuel have two different opinions about what is the major nature of our Haggadah. So when the rabbis were putting the Haggadah Shel Pesach, the Passover Haggadah together, the question is, we have to begin with disparagement. How we had as Jewish people, we came from very humble beginnings. And what are those humble beginnings? So each one sees a different humble beginning. Shmuel, Samuel says, the humble beginning clearly is you guys were slaves in Egypt. That's pretty low. Rav says, well, I agree, that is low, but that's not enough. You got to go all the way back to the source of our ignoble beginnings. That Abraham and Sarah, we are all descended from Abraham and Sarah. And Abraham's dad, Terach, had an idol shop. They used to worship idols, Avodah Zarah. In fact, he had an idol shop in Babylon. You may have heard of it. It was called Idols Are Us. Now, they went out of business like Toys R Us. But unlike Toys R Us, nobody took a hammer to all the toys. But the famous story, Abraham was in charge. He was managing that day in the absence of his father, Terach. And he took and crushed all the idols in the store except for the biggest one. And when his father came home, his dad looked around. The business was a mess. He said, what happened? He goes, well, a lady came with an offering. And all the idols started fighting who deserves the offering. And the big idol, the Andre the Giant idol, crushed all the others. It was like a WrestleMania Royal Rumble. And it crushed all the others. And it's the only one standing. So Dad Terach looked at Abraham and said, Abraham, what are you talking about? What kind of crazy story is this? The idols are just pieces of wood and stone. I manufacture them. I get them from places like in Bangladesh and China, even back then. He says, I know they're manufactured. They're not real. So he says, well, Dad, if they're not real, why would you sell them and worship them? Of course, Dad was not pleased. And there's a whole backstory which we're not going to go into. Now, by the way, as a little humor here, Terach, father of Abraham, who's mentioned, by the way, in the Haggadah, it says, Terach Avi Avram, Terach, father of Avram. So he used to sell the idols and was immersed in idolatry. So he's walking to work one day at Toys R Us, at Idols R Us, and someone says, hey, Terach, good to see you. Good morning. How you doing? He goes, thank God. So with that, we have these two superficially disparate opinions on the nature of what the Haggadah has to have. And by the way, we have both. We have a section that begins right after the four questions, the Manishtanas from Seymour Goldfarb. Why is this night different from all other nights? We have the Avadim Hayinu, we were slaves. That's right there in the Haggadah, which fulfills the vision of Samuel Shmuel. And then we have Mitchila Ovei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoseinu. That in the beginning, we used to worship idols in the time of Terah. So both are included in the Haggadah. Well, so again, this is a review. This is critical, though. What are they hitting on? What are they saying? What do you mean? What's the difference between we have to go back to the slavery or we have to go back to the idolatry? Because there are two types of slavery. The bondage, the slavery that we experienced in Egypt was bodily. We were physically slaves. And we needed to get out. That is Samuel. We were physically slaves. Rav says, okay, that's true. But there's also a spiritual slavery, which is more pernicious, more of an issue, and it doesn't begin with the experience in Egypt. No, you got to go all the way back to the father of Abraham to discover the nature of real slavery. And real slavery is when people were immersed in idolatry, in an alternate reality that wasn't real, and they were enslaved. That's why it's avodah. Zarah means literally worship, imprisonment of something alien. So you got to go back there. So in other words, both are true. Now you might ask, well, Rabbi, you're talking semantics. Okay, there's a bodily, physical slavery. There's a spiritual slavery. What difference does it make? Well, it makes a huge difference. I'll illustrate this. You ready? In America, I'm sure everyone here has been to Philadelphia to visit the Liberty Bell. So there is a word for freedom that is liberty. Dror, it's a common Israeli name, very nice name, means liberty. On the Liberty Bell, it says, you shall declare liberty throughout the land. It does not use the word freedom. Dror, it's a verse in Leviticus, in Vayikra. Okay, it's right on the Liberty Bell, I promise you. Declare liberty throughout the land for all its inhabitants, right? Right there. So you're at liberty. But then there's another concept of freedom. So Samuel is addressing the body imprisonment. That is to be at liberty. Once a person is freed from their prison, they are at liberty. So soldiers would say, let's use the Navy as a great analogy, right? When the Navy ships pull into port in Manila or in Singapore or wherever, and they've been at sea for 3 months or 6 months, they are at liberty. I will not go to the dark side of these places that they visit, but all the things that they weren't allowed to do on the ship, they let their hair down, if they had any hair, because they're in the Navy, right? They let their hair down in the most egregious way possible by imbibing in every type of forbidden behavior. That's at liberty, right? The ship pulls into port, you're at liberty. But that's freedom physically. Freedom from the constraints of the ship or freedom from the constraints of being under Yul Brynner, Pharaoh's clutches. But then there's also spiritual liberty. And that is not dependent upon body freedom. It's something else that we'll discuss momentarily. That is freedom of the spirit of the soul. So ostensibly, a person could be free bodily, but emotionally, spiritually, they're still prisoners. And how do I illustrate this in a very powerful way? This will be meaningful, I hope, to you. We know that until this very day, the African-American population of the United States still suffers from certain identity issues. That's why you even hear right now about the idea of reparations being floated in places like California and Oregon or wherever. It's been a long time since the Civil War, right? 1860s. I mean, it's been a really long time since the War of the States. Why would that still be an issue all these years later? Because the issue there was a war was fought, and the people who won the war, thankfully the North won, and they freed the slaves, emancipation. But emancipation is to be at liberty. It doesn't address the deeper component of to be free. So therefore, one of my rabbis who's teaching what I'm teaching you, he said that's why there's an issue. That's why there's still an identity crisis amongst certain populations that were imprisoned. They were at liberty, yes, but they never learned what it meant to be free. And therefore, they questioned their place in America and whether they really are free and what it means for them. So what does that mean to the Jewish people? Well, suppose everyone answers the question. What if God had, instead of doing the 10 plagues, what if he had just brought out the big one, the 10th one, death of the firstborn? And he even tells Moshe, right? Tells Moses right up front, Pharaoh will keep changing his mind. You're not going to get out of Dodge until the 10th and final plague. Then he'll let you go. And we, as we know, he changed his mind 3 days later. But at least temporarily, you'll get out, correct? Why not just bring out the big ammunition? Why go through blood and frogs? And again, I know it's fun to dip your little pinky in the grape juice and in the wine. Okay, but do you really need? What is this, like a prize fight where you need to sort of soften up the fighter for 10 rounds with body shots before you hit you knock him out in the 10th or 12th round? I mean, this is not a boxing match. Well, it kind of sounds like that, right? Everything is sort of like a body shot and until finally the big ammunition comes out. I mean, it's ridiculous. God could pull out the big ammunition anytime he wants to, and you're done. But what would that prove? God's more powerful than a mortal human named Pharaoh? It's very arbitrary. And if the Jewish people at that point were slaves one moment earlier, and now one moment later they get out, then they have that same issue of emancipation. They're still essentially free to do what exactly? They're at liberty to do what? So this is what Rav is addressing. He says, much more important than just getting out of Dodge, you need to have this spiritual freedom, and that is what Passover is all about. You have to address what it means to be a prisoner of the mind and the soul, not just the body. So according to this rabbi, his name is Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi in Source 1. We used to call him by his acronym, the Riff. He was also a tremendous lead guitarist. They called him the Riff. I'm sorry. Sorry about that one. Okay. I know. Great rabbis, by the way, have acronyms. And the better the acronym, we don't even remember the rabbi's name. You know, so like you could say Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki. Not everybody remembers what his actual name was because he's so famous just with an acronym. It's called, do you remember there was a yogurt place called TCBY? Yeah. All right, I don't think it really exists anymore, but it was called The Country's Best Yogurt. But nobody remembered what it was, or KFC. One day somebody promoted KFC and said, you know, people don't like fried food anymore, so we're going to fool the dumb public, and we're just going to go by the acronym KFC, and therefore the people who are sensitive to the oil and the fried food, they won't even remember that it's fried. And of course they were right. Right? So today you probably ask Gen Xer, what is that F in the KFC? Right. They won't even know what it is. So that's what happens with the rabbis, like the Riff. Other than his magical guitar playing with Led Zeppelin, he also was a great, formidable posek. So he says we do both. He says that we're having too much fun here, I know, Rita. So I am having too much fun, too much caffeine today. So so the bottom line is that we need to address at the Passover Seder, the source of our freedom, we need to address these two components, liberty and freedom. And just very simply to illustrate what that means. To be at liberty would mean I walk into my favorite deli, let's say in Teaneck they have Noah's Ark, and they give you a very big menu. And you're thinking to yourself, oh my gosh, that Romanian pastrami, that sounds great. But wait a minute, that hard salami. I never eat hard salami. Wow. And then you're looking at the menu and they have like, you know, kasha varnishes, whatever. And you're thinking, well, wait a minute. Right? So if you decide with great difficulty what to choose, so you choose the Romanian pastrami over the corned beef, that is sort of to be at liberty to make a choice. But that impact of your choice, other than the waistline impact, has no impact on your spiritual self and your essence of growth. Whereas Rav, who's addressing idolatry and the greater to be not just at liberty, but to be able to make life-affirming and life-changing decisions, that already is a different level. Because we suffer from idol worship today. Then you might say, Rabbi, what are you talking about? Idol worship today? Yeah, because idol worship doesn't mean a conventional idol worship. Right? We're not praying. Right? It could be the iPhone. That's why it's called an iPhone. Right? Okay. It could be your smartphone that we're imprisoned by. But the world imprisons each other through narratives and things that are very hard to get out of. It's very hard to break a narrative. So any narrative could theoretically be a source of imprisonment. And that's why on Passover, we try to reset, we recalibrate your hard drive so that you experience new things, innovative things, something that's a chidush, something that you haven't thought of before, and we hopefully with something new and improved, you break out of the old and you do something going forward. You say, oh my gosh, wow, I'm no longer the same person because I changed one little part of who I am. And that's why in Passover, we use a Socratic method of questioning and answering. We rely upon the youths of our lives, because hopefully a young child will still have that sense of wonder and geschmack in the world. And they look at things and they have a sense of, why is this? Why is that? As we learn how things are in the world, what happens? What happens is we learn how things work, the magic of Disney, but we lose the wonder of life. We become jaded, just part of the human experience as we grow up. So Passover, we use the children of our lives, right? We even have a theka. We have the aftikomen. What's the aftikomen? To keep the kids engaged till the end, right? Oh my gosh, that's all they taught. I promise you. You get a 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old, maybe an 80-year-old come into your Seder. All they want to know is, what's the present going to be? And they're keeping an eye. Dad, did Dad or Grandpa, did he steal the aftikomen when we weren't watching, when we went out to do this? Someone pinched the aftikomen. Like in my house, the joke was, we never saw the Elijah cup, that fifth cup that we pour when we open the door for Elijah. I never got my mother, Alel Shalom, to confess. But every time we were somewhere else, somebody came and spilled some of that wine. And I said, my mom said, you missed Elijah. Eliyahu was here. I said, doggone it. Every year I never see Elijah. I suspect my mom had something to do with that. But okay. So be that as it may, we try to capture the imagination of the audience. And that's why commonly Haggadahs that you buy, even adult Haggadahs, will have like pictures, drawings, artistry. Because, you know, a picture's worth 1,000 words. And it allows us to capture imagery, which visually helps us to process, because we have different modalities of learning, right? I mean, I'm sure you know, especially if any of you are teachers, you have some people who respond very much to auditory processing of learning. Some are visual learners. Some are tactile learners. Do you ever think about a Seder, how remarkable it is? Every one of those is met. They give you like charoses to feel the mortar. You dip stuff in this and dip this in this. So you get the tactile, people who need to touch something, hold something. That is accounted for. Obviously the visuals, you have the Passover Haggadah with pictures and all the beautiful Seder plate. Everyone's looking at the tables all dressed up in a different way. So that appeals to the visual learner, the auditory learner for who listens by, you know, by hearing, listening and hearing, and they learn. Again, that's accounted for. So it's every type of modality of learning is accounted for, because we want to hit you where you are. So let us now look at source two. So now, this is going to segue onto source one. Source one discussed for us the two opinions of these great rabbis. Just to remind ourselves, the rabbi named Rav, he was of the opinion that you got to go back to the idolatry, ignoble beginnings. And then Shmuel said, no, it's just about slavery in Egypt. So listen to this. One must begin the narrative to describing our ancestors with their base roots and conclude with their praise. What does this imply? And I'll read it, but then I'll explain it. One begins relating, which is that word Haggadah, by the way, means to relate over, to tell over. One begins relating how originally, we said this, so that's a review. In the age of Terach, the idols are us guy, our ancestors denied God's existence and strayed after vanity, pursuing idolatry, idol worship. One concludes with the true faith, how the omnipresent Hashem has drawn us close to him, separated us from the Gentiles, and drawn us near to his oneness. Similarly, so that first opinion that I just cited was all Rav. Now comes Shmuel. Similarly, one begins by stating that we were slaves to Pharaoh, to Yul Brynner in Egypt, and describing all the evil done to us, and concludes with the miracles and wonders that were wrought upon us in our freedom. This implies, we don't know why, but this is what we're going to have to try to explain, that one should extrapolate the passage beginning from Deuteronomy 26:5, an Aramean, probably a reference to Lavan, the wicked father-in-law of Jacob. An Aramean Lavan sought to destroy my ancestor, Jacob, Yaakov, until one concludes the entire passage. And then he adds, beautifully, this is all Maimonides, the Rambam, another great acronym, whoever adds and extends his extrapolation of this passage Hare zeh mishubach is praiseworthy to do more and more. Okay, so here's the question. Let's back up. So we need to fulfill in the Haggadah both the opinion of Rav, idolatry, because that's where we began our imprisonment of the spirit, and slavery in Egypt, Shmuel, Samuel's opinion, which is the bodily at liberty issue, correct? But then it says, what's the source for all this? Well, let me ask you a question. There's a book, the second book of the Torah, it's called Exodus, Shemot. And I promise you, I'm a rabbi, you can take my word on this. There are not one, but four parshas, four whole Torah readings that are dedicated with every detail and every nuance to the story of the Exodus. Because it's the book of Exodus. You have the first one, Exodus, Shemot. And then you have Va'era, and then you have Bo, and then finally Bishalach takes you through the Red Sea and you get out of Egypt. So you have four parshas. Wouldn't you think that if I'm compiling a book that's supposed to recreate Egypt and Pharaoh, wouldn't the book of Exodus be my source? Yeah? No. The Rambam, Maimonides in number 2, said, you got to look at Deuteronomy 26:5. Deuteronomy, Devarim. Now remember, the Torah has 5 books. The 5th book, Deuteronomy, I think he was the old cat in that cat's thing. Old Deuteronomy, remember? Oh, yeah, he was the old cat. All right, old Deuteronomy. So Deuteronomy, Devarim, is Mishnah Torah. It is a review of the first 4 books of the Torah, ostensibly from the Moshe perspective, but really God's perspective. It's like almost like an editorial. We take all the highlights of the first 4 books, and then God explains kind of like extra stuff, like what it means for us. Well, rather than do the editorial page, why can't I go to the reporting page, which would be the book of Exodus? Why, like, skip the entire book that's called Exodus and go right to Devarim, Deuteronomy? And not only that, but according to Maimonides, this is the only way you can fulfill your biblical commandment of the night of Passover. Isn't that weird? It's bizarre. Strange. Now, where is that biblical commandment? Ah, I'm glad you asked. It says in the Torah, V'higadeta levincha. V'higadeta, Haggadah. Like that word Haggadah that we use, that book that we use on Passover. It says, V'higadeta levincha b'yomahu lemor. You shall tell over to your child on that day, saying, this is what God did for me when he took me out of Egypt. So that is the requirement that we have every year to get together on Monday night and to have the matzah and the maror and the 4 cups and all that stuff. From that word, v'higadeta levincha, you shall tell over to your child on that day. Okay, but wouldn't you think that if the kids come prepared with all the verses from Exodus, that they would be like ready to rock and roll? And they're disappointed because all the quotations really are from the book of Devarim, Deuteronomy. It's kind of like the wrong part of the Chumash. Like, what's going on? Why would that be? So what we're going to explore now is, in answering that question, we are going to try to understand that not only is it a requirement not to use Exodus for some reason, but it's going to seamlessly put the whole perspective of the Haggadah together. And it's also going to bring us back to the opinions of whether it should be at liberty, whether it should be a spiritual awakening or a physical awakening, liberty versus freedom. And it all is going to relate to one remarkable human being, your great-great-grandfather, Abraham, Avraham Avinu. Everyone in this room, Jewish by birth, Jewish by choice, you are a child of Abraham. How do I know this? Because when a Jew by birth is a Jew by birth, then you trace the lineage, the DNA, to Abraham. If you're a Jew by choice, do you want to guess what your father becomes? Abraham. Yeah. You become known officially when a person converts to Judaism. So a Jew by choice becomes a child, a son or a daughter of Avraham Avinu, of Abraham. And your mom becomes Sarah. Remarkable, right? So it's clear that Abraham is the beginning of the nation, what we came to be known as the B'nai Israel, the children of Israel. It all started with Abraham. And Abraham is critical to understanding the Haggadah because he asks a famous question. You ready? So let's look at source number 3. And source number 3 is the quote from Deuteronomy. And I'm just going to read part of it, not the whole thing. I know it looks like, wow. Boy, Rabbi, you came with really long quotations today. But I promise you, it won't be that daunting. Now, this is the quote from Deuteronomy that was bothering us. Like, why Deuteronomy and not Exodus? So here is the quote that the Maimonides said, remember back in the second source, he said that you have to fulfill your mitzvah, your requirement of the Haggadah, not from Exodus, but from Deuteronomy. And he said 26:5. So you'll notice at the bottom of source 3, it's 26:1-9. So I have the entire segment of verses here. You ready? I'll read it very, very quickly. And it will be, when you come into the land of Israel, which the Lord your God gives you for an inheritance, and you possess it and settle in it, that you shall take of the first of all the fruit of the ground, which you will bring from your land, which the Lord your God is giving you. And you shall put them, the fruit, into a basket. Go to the place which the Lord your God will choose, Jerusalem. I'm putting words in to make it make sense. To have his name dwell there, to the temple. And you shall come to the Kohen, the priest, who will be serving in those days. And you will say to the priest, you're the farmer. I declare this day to the Lord your God that I have come to the land which the Lord swore to our forefathers to give us. And the Kohen, the priest, will take the basket from your hand, laying it before the altar of the Lord your God. And you shall call out and say before the Lord your God, an Aramean, there's that quote that we had in Maimonides, an Aramean, Laban, sought to destroy my forefather Jacob, and he went down to Egypt. He sojourned there with a small number of people, and there he became a great and mighty and numerous nation. And the Egyptians treated us cruelly and afflicted us, and they imposed hard labor upon us. So we cried out to the Lord our God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voices, our affliction, our toil, and our oppression. And the Lord brought us out from the Egypt with a strong hand, with an outstretched arm, with great awe, with signs and wonders. And he brought us to this place, Israel, and he gave us this land, Eretz Zavas Chalav Devash, a land flowing with milk and honey. So that's the entirety of the quote. So if you know your Haggadah, and I'm sure some of you are like experts in the Haggadah, you will notice that these verses are all in the Haggadah. They're the main part of the Haggadah. And each one, they say, oh, they treated us cruelly. That teaches us X, Y, Z. We start to extrapolate from the Talmud and different sources how they treated us poorly. How all these, in other words, these verses give us like a structure, an overview, if you will, the cliff notes of the entire process from beginning to the redemption, the end of the Exodus. But in the Haggadah, it teaches us all the little things about what happened. And again, this is all the vision of Maimonides. He said it's the only way you can tell the story of Haggadah over is not from the book of Exodus, but from these 9 verses. And so therefore, you shouldn't be surprised. Those 9 verses are what make up the major part of Magid, of telling the story of the Exodus right in the Haggadah. They're all there, I promise you. When you will, Monday night, you'll see that every one of these verses, and they say like 3 or 4 or 5, 6 words. They say, what does that teach us? That they did this. They did bad to us. They drowned our children. Whatever. It goes through like all the little minutiae of the history. So that's the extrapolation that we've discussed. So again, let's reiterate the question. You have a book of Exodus with 4 magical parts that recount in real time the story. Why do you have to sort of backdoor your way, not from Exodus, which would be too simple, but you got to go to Deuteronomy? And not only that, what if you ignore Maimonides? Let's say you opened your book of Exodus. You said, wait a minute, all that stuff is in the book of Exodus. I'm just going to use Exodus because I'm smarter than Maimonides. A, you ain't smarter than Maimonides. He had an IQ of about 350, according to some people. Very smart man, brilliant man, Reb Moshe Ben Maimon. He was a doctor, astronomer, did a lot of things a long time ago. So he's a brilliant guy. He was Galileo before there was a Galileo, okay? Brilliant man. Da Vinci before there was a Da Vinci. So Maimonides, you can't outthink Maimonides. So if you did that, if you used the book of Exodus rather than using these 9 verses from Deuteronomy, you did not fulfill your biblical mandate to do the Haggadah correctly. You did something, and it's okay, but you didn't do it the way we ordained that you should do it. Why is that? So here is the question. I mentioned to you a couple moments ago that the mitzvah, the commandment of the evening, is the higadetah. You shall relate, to tell over. That's where we get the word haggadah from, to tell over. There are only two times in the entirety of the Torah, the five books of Moses, where that word haggadah is used. One is what I just quoted you. You shall relate over to your children. Do you want to take a guess? You only get three guesses and two don't count. Where else in the whole narrative of our Chumash, our entire five books of Moses, do you find that same word Haggadah mentioned? Only other time. It's right here in Deuteronomy 1-9. You didn't catch it because I was a fake up. But it says, I declare this day to the Lord your God. I declare, because I didn't put the Hebrew there, is Higadeti Hayom Lashem. I declare, they use the word Haggadah. Oh, now it makes sense. Think about it. If all it tells us is you should tell over to your child, it doesn't tell us what to tell over. So what do? You leaf through your Chumash, through your Torah, and you come to this Deuteronomy 1-9. You say, oh, wait a minute. There's that word Haggadah here, and there was the word Haggadah there. Since in the context of the original tell your child over, didn't tell us what to do. What does it mean, telling it over? But here, it does tell us what to do. Telling the story. It must be then that the word Haggadah here and the word Haggadah here is meant to be connected. It's called a hekesh, a gzer shava. It's one of the ways we learn Torah. We compare words that are from a Masorah, from a tradition, meant to be compared. Compare and contrast. So therefore, the only way you can fulfill your biblical mandate to tell over to your child Haggadah, the Higadatah, is by the other word Haggadah, which is here by the first fruit. Weird. By the first fruit. Okay, just to give you a quick primer, as they would say in England, since we have the Queen of England as our joke. A primer would be that the first fruit were the barley harvest, usually the Omer. And they would, whatever was the first to grow, the farmer would take the first fruit and he would be joyous, he or she, and would come up to Jerusalem and present the first fruits. And then they would declare all this stuff out loud about how I have arrived in the land of Israel that God promised me. And I'm so grateful to be here. Here are my first fruits that I grew with my own hands here in the Holy Land of Israel. So why is this germane? Let's look at source number 4. Please turn the back of the page. Okay. Now, remember I promised you that the linchpin was Abraham. So now we're going to see how Abraham really fits in, and it's all going to come together. God will. And Hashem, God said to Avram, to Abram. That was before he was known as Abraham. He gets elevated to the extra name change, but not yet. So in the context of Genesis 15, he's still Avram. He's not Avraham. Okay, he means he's a chief, but he's not a chief of many nations yet. And Hashem said to Abram, to Abram, I am the Lord who brought you forth from the Ur of the Chaldees, me Ur Kasdim, that was back in Babylonia area, to give you this land of Israel to inherit it. And he, Abraham, said, O Lord God, how will I know that I will inherit it? Now the sun was ready to set, and a deep sleep fell upon Abram. And behold, a fright. A great darkness was falling upon him. Choshech, a fela. And Hashem, God, said to Avram, you shall surely know that your seed will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and they will enslave them, meaning the Egyptians will enslave them and oppress them for 400 years. And also the nation of Egypt that they will serve will I judge, God says to Avram. And afterwards, they, the Jewish people, I like the pronouns, that's why I'm throwing the names in, they, the Jewish people, will go forth with great possessions. But you, Abraham, will come to your forefathers, means you'll die in peace. You'll be buried in a good old age, 175 years. And the fourth generation will return here, meaning of your children, for the iniquity of the Amorites will not be completed until then. This is Genesis 15:7. This little segment comes from one of the most important areas in the Torah. This is called the Brit Bein HaBetarim. The bris ben habasarim, the covenant between the parts. This is where there's a full disclosure, God to Abraham, about what the nature of the history of the Jewish people will be, how everything will play out. So embedded in this is everything that will be the future of the Jews, including right now. I'll explain in a second. So Abraham asks a question. Do you remember his question? Let's go back to the beginning of source 4. And Hashem said to Abram, I am the Lord who brought you forth from Ur to give you this land to inherit it. And look at Abraham's question. Oh, Lord God, how will I know that I will inherit it? He says, B'ma eto, how will I know? Ki irashana, that I will, when he says I will inherit, it means his children. How will I know that we'll get Israel? By what right? If it's an inheritance because you love us, what if maybe we tick you off and you don't love us anymore, so you're going to take Israel away? What, there's a lot of things that could go wrong. So instead of directly answering Abraham, look at the, talk about a doche, like an answer that is sort of like a non-answer. Look what he says. His answer is, this is in the fourth line at the end. Abraham, you shall surely know, this is the answer supposedly to his question, that your seed, your children, will be strangers in a strange land. Is that, what? How does that help me at all? Okay, I ask God, God, how will I know that my children one day will inherit the land of Israel? So God says, you want to know? Because your children will all be slaves in Egypt. That's, how is that like,
candle and stick.
How is that a promise? How does that, and it's the answer, because it's clear from this that Abraham was appeased. He felt comforted. He was ready to go to his maker in his old age. Now this quote, by the way, is literally in, you're not surprised here, the Haggadah. It's quote, the quote, right? He's you know, that Zarecha Etein, he says, you know, Avani, right? And then it talks about that, he talks about Abraham, and it says that your children will be strangers in a strange land, right? Ger yezarecha be'eretz lo lahem, right? That's the quote from the Haggadah. Sure, it sounds a little familiar to you. Your children will be strangers in a strange land. Well, how does that an answer? And why, pray tell, I promised you this, how do we fix the thing with the Deuteronomy Exodus, where the only way to fulfill the day, the night of Passover and the day of Passover, the Haggadah experience, is by not going Exodus, but going to Deuteronomy? Well, how does this all relate? It's all perfect. You ready? So here's what Abraham's asking. I want to know, God, I'm not going to live to see this. I'm pretty old already. What's the surety? What's the absolute ironclad promise that my descendants will get Israel? And he says, well, they're going to go to Egypt. But then they're going to get out of Egypt, and they'll get to Israel eventually. So how is that an answer? It's a magical answer. God is saying to Abraham, do you know why your children will get Israel? It's not a promise that I'm making based on I love them. I mean, I do. But you're right. They could fall out of favor at any time. You know what it's based upon? You and your genetics. Because you, Abraham, are going to give, along with Sarah, your children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, your DNA. And because they possess your DNA, they will never, ever be crushed by Pharaoh. No matter what horrific thing Pharaoh throws at the Jewish people, because they're your offspring, they're going to get out of there one way or another. They will get to Israel. That's my promise to you. Now, that's a powerful idea. It's not based on merit, not based on a promise of love or whatever. It's based on a reality of the genetics of Abraham and Sarah, that their children have it in them, that Abraham and Sarah gave to them and to us, I will add, that potentiality to never be subjugated long term. We'll always get out. So what does that mean? It means that as horrific as the predicament of the Jewish people could be in Egypt or anywhere else, and by the way, I won't go in there, but all the other words, he says that there's a deep sleep, and there was a fright, and a great darkness. These are all allusions, the rabbis say, to future galios, to future exiles. We are right now in the last exile. Sounds like a movie, The Last Exile. This is the exile of Edom, the Edomites. When Jacob goes up that ladder, he sees the angels going up and down the ladder, and that angel, the last one's going up and up and up. Every rung he goes up until Jacob can't see the top of the ladder. And God says, it's okay. That's the Esav, that's the Edomite ladder. if I have to intercede and knock the angel off, you'll get out of this. So right now, we're, even though we have Israel, thank God, we haven't finished the process. So we're still in Gullus. We're still in exile right now. But that was hinted to in this story that I just read you, that there would be all these darkness and future exiles, but you'll get through every one of them. How are you going to get through Abraham? Because they are you, and you are them. How do we see this? Because, go back, I won't force you to go back to source 3. I'm just going to paraphrase to make it easy for you. So in the story of the farmer bringing the first fruits, remember he has to make a declaration, Haggadah. He says, Higadati ayom, kivasi el haaretz, I have come to the land. What did God say to Abraham in his promise when he put him to sleep and had this incredible back and forth with him? He said, one day they will get to the land of Israel. Who is the first person to culminate that vision and promise to Abraham? You know who that was? The Jewish farmer. By coming to the temple in Israel, bringing their first fruits, he is declaring to the priest, I have arrived. When he says, I have arrived, it's not just himself. It's Abraham has arrived. So in other words, everything that Abraham asked from God is fulfilled. Every single year there was a temple, and the farmer would bring the produce to Jerusalem and make that declaration, I've arrived, here we are in Israel. This is a kiyum, it's a fulfillment of the promise that Abraham got from God, because they're your genetics, they're your DNA. And therefore, that is why it's an answer, right? Because he says, how do I know? Because your children one day will get there, no matter how difficult the journey. They will arrive there because they're you. They will take no shortcuts. They have your genetics. They will never be subjugated and extinguished. I promise you, Abraham. Therefore, the farmer arriving with the basket is testifying that God is good and that God kept his promise to Abraham. Okay? So that is why, if you think about it, the Haggadah fits so perfectly. Because it's all built around Abraham's question. Now remember, Abraham's the one who is fighting against what? Idolatry, because it was his dad, Terach, who had the idols or a shop. He's the one who crushes the idols. So that pernicious form of imprisonment, which wasn't just limited to bodily imprisonment, which was Samuel Shmuel's vision, that you got to get out of Egypt, it's deeper. So Abraham helps us to fight to reclaim the freedom of our spirit. And that is what Passover is each and every year. So it makes sense that when we retell the story of the Exodus, we don't go to Exodus. We go to the story of the narrative of that farmer, because that brings us full circle. In other words, the circle is closed by the farmer to that magical story of Abraham that is recounted in Deuteronomy by the first fruits. It all seamlessly fits one another. But here's where it gets more delicious. Do you know who Natan Sharansky is? So Anatoly Sharansky was probably the most famous refusnik in the old evil empire known as the Soviet Union. And he was beaten down and subjugated in the most profound way possible. He now lives in Israel. He was a member of the Israel Parliament, the MK, Natan Sharansky. I actually had the honor of being in his presence in Memphis years ago. Memphis presented him with the keys to the city because he fought against Brezhnev and Kosygin, I mean, the biggest, most murderous people who subjugated the Jews like almost nobody else other than Hitler, I guess, and Stalin. I mean, it's the same mode, okay? And I'll never forget this. The mayor of Memphis, his name was Willie Harrington. He was about 6'7", very handsome African-American man. And he's the mayor, and he's immaculately dressed. And he gets up on the bima, the dais of the Baronhurst Synagogue in Memphis, to present Mr. Sharansky with this award from the city. And he's 6'7". Majestic. And Sharansky, who is like Steve Rogers, he's like Captain, I wouldn't call him Captain America, he's Captain Israel. He's like about 5'3½", balding, chubby, and he's like 5'3". It got so ridiculous, the scene of this 6'7" majestic man, this little pudgy guy, and you know who is the superhero and who is not, that even Harrington, the mayor, like looked. And he realized the absurdity of this picture. And he made, I don't remember exactly what he said, but he made some little sort of offhand comment saying, well, I'm not the real hero, even though I look like the hero. It's Sharansky. So Sharansky recounts in his biography an amazing moment in his life. He's in the gulag. He's being sentenced to life imprisonment in Siberia. And, you know, you don't get an attorney. It's a rigged system. There's no way out of the system. Okay. He recounts that this judge throws him in a holding cell because of Sharansky's refusal to acquiesce to the demands of the judge. And he's in this little holding cell, so small that he can't even sit down in the holding cell. And he's not the first. He's probably the 10,000th poor guy who's been subjugated by the Soviets. And he's in the cell, and he has a matchbook. And he starts to light up matches. He has nothing else to do. And he notices scribbled all over the wall are expletives and some very not complimentary things about Brezhnev and the Soviets and the whole empire, right? Because everybody who's been there, who knows where they are and if they even made it. And at that point, Sharansky said, I was broken. I was a broken human being facing life in Siberia, in the gulag. I had no vision to go forward. And as he's in that cell with his one of his last matches, he catches sight of a very weird thing. On the bottom of the wall, he sees a Star of David. Star of David, like crudely cut into the wall. So now he takes out his matchbook, he lights all the rest of the matches, and he's kneeling down. And it says, Yosef Bigon, who was one of the prisoners of Zion. That's what he called himself. He was one of the earlier refuseniks to Sharansky. He had been in that cell. And he wrote, Yosef Bigon, prisoner of Zion, meaning prisoner of Israel. And then he wrote under that, Am Yisrael Chai, the children of Israel will live. And Sharansky said, at that moment, I knew I could live. I would continue. I would win. And that's what it means to be a child of Abraham. That they can lock you in a gulag. It's not going to break the spirit of the Jew. That's what Abraham's promised. We have Abraham's genetics. So I ask you a question. Who is a bigger prisoner? Sharansky or Brezhnev and the Soviets who created the evil system? He's clearly freer. Because yes, bodily, he's not at liberty, right? But the freedom that he has in his mind and his soul is unlimited. And that's what it means to be free on Passover. I wish everyone a Chag Kasher V'Sameach, a wonderful Passover.